the wetland, and you can follow that other stone wall north to where I'm trying to get you to. Or you could do what I do, which is instead of doing anything when you cross this stone wall, you just notice it, and you continue north on the path for maybe another 100 yards. There's a place where it forks. There's a little side path forks off to the expensive houses over on the right. And around there, you head straight west. You go downhill, and you'll hit a place that's surrounded by very peculiar stone walls that are zigzagging back and forth inexplicably. It goes about through five turns. There's a place where a brook goes through a culvert three times in a row. And for what? I'd have to show you a picture, but the stone walls are sort of zigzagging around. I mean, it's like they're coming down and going out and then going back in, and the brook is going in and out, and you're going, what is going on there? It's an entire ruin of something there, which nobody knows what that is, but I can tell you that there's a triangle of land slightly higher right behind it that's enclosed by stone walls. It's making it a triangle, and it's filled with about 30 low piles on the ground. Many of them have one piece of quartz in it. And we don't know if this is a burial or not, because I'm not going to dig it up. But if I had to say what a burial should look like this, it's that. I don't know what it is, but I always call it a burial ground. There are three places where the rock piles are not low and to the ground. In each corner, one of them appears to be a turtle effigy, one of them appears to be a crow effigy, and the third one has been badly damaged, and I can't make any sense of it.
Effigies made out of the stone piles?
Yeah, so you'll find stone piles that appear to be shaped like something. Turtle-shaped rock piles are pretty common, so with a head and feet and a dome and a tail. There's other things. I mean, there's this one place where lightning strikes all the time in Carlisle, and there seem to be a bunch of bird shapes underneath them on the ground. And you go, well, could those be thunderbirds? This is just my imagination. I don't know. There's, you know, interpreting rock piles is obviously as much artistic wishful thinking as reality. You don't really know. Sometimes it's unmistakable that that's got to have been deliberate, that it's made that way. And I could go on about that, but it's a rather hard to pin down reality, so I don't think it's worth talking about too much. But if you go out there and look around, you'll see lots of different kinds of rock piles, and I'll finish up, well, maybe tell it while you're thinking of it, that way if you forget it later. So I ended my story with arrowheads by telling you what's going on in the present, which was that there are not as many fields plowed as before, not as many arrowhead hunting opportunities as before, but I'm still going out. I'm going to spend, you know, an hour, 1 hour of in the entire spring. Let me tell you a little bit more about where the rock pile stuff is going. But I'm not sure if I've set the context properly. So I noticed something funny in the woods with rock piles. I also started taking pictures of them.
Okay. Hold and then talk.
Sorry.
That's okay.
You know there are rock. Say, well, no.
I said
this
I.
This is absolutely wrong.
By the way, there's quite a few rock piles in West Virginia. If you check your local newspapers, there's a lot of controversy going on about the people in West Virginia are just going, "Oh, could these be Native American?" And then a few other people going, "We've got some stuff just like that on the next mountain over." So West Virginia is actually right now is a hotbed of people becoming aware of rock piles. Georgia has been a place where people have been aware of rock piles for quite a long time. They have a very famous eagle mound down there. It's one huge quartz eagle shaped made out of rocks. It's a mound, but it's made out of rocks. And they actually, down in Georgia, they actually do the dirty and they dig up rock piles. Look inside them, and they've found human remains in some. They found very peculiar ceremonial. They'll find a bit of a turtle shell and a deer bone in the middle of a rock pile. They'll find a chunk of. Well, these guys dug up a rock pile in Freetown, Mass, and they found something like 20 pounds of hematite, which is the blood red ochre, which is used in burials from the Neanderthal onward. You know, you've probably heard of red ochre or red paint. That's out where prejudices against Native American existence aren't limiting the conceptualizing of the past the way that is happening here. So in West Virginia, you don't have quite the same barriers we have in New England to seeing what's in front of your nose. In Georgia, apparently, they have very few such barriers, and Native American stonework is well recognized, understood, and it's, I guess, a budding field of research nowadays because they're realizing that, gosh, every time you put in a federal project, you got to deal with this. I was going to tell you more about the future and present of rock pile hunting, but I think I need to tell you some stories about the Indians first. A very good story. I hope I have some time for this. So, one of the people I knew from the New England Antiquities Research Association board was a lady called Linda McElroy, who's in charge of the land stewardship program in Acton. Linda has long been a proponent of, you know, there's weird stuff in the woods. So there's this people who don't know about the woods, and then there's the one who go, there's weird stuff in the woods. So I'm in that camp, and Linda McElroy, I knew her, she knew me. I did the web page for the NERA organization.
Could you spell
her
name?
What?
Linda, L-I-N-D-A, McElroy, Irish McElroy.
Did you say I did the web page again?
I did the web page for the New England Antiquities Research Association, also called NERA.
N-E-R-A.
N-E-R-A, and I was a member of the board of NERA for several years, and I'm still considered a person of value to the organization. I push them around, they don't mind. They pushed me around a little bit. Linda called me up one time where I was speaking with her. She said, Susie Mitchell-Hart.
This is great.
What?
What you're saying.
It's good stuff. Good stories.
Susie.
Good stuff.
Yeah, Susie Mitchell-Hart, who's a wheeler dealer of a parent-teacher association sort of lady, and I don't mean to mischaracterize her. She's a really nice lady. And she knows a lot of people, and she has a lot of interactions. I knew her because my kids were in school with her kids, and she knew Linda McElroy because she lives on the edge of Acton and is involved with many things. And she had introduced Linda to a fellow named Jick Davis, who lives on the corner of East Street and Pope Road. J-I-C Davis. And she said,
in
Carlisle, southern end of Carlisle, right at the edge with Concord. Linda, I was talking to her somehow by the phone. She said, you really should contact this guy in Carlisle. He's got jade. He's got a place where there's jade. He's got jade coming out of there. I go, what, jade in Carlisle? Pshaw. Could not be. don't be foolish. She said, well, can you get in touch with this guy? So I called him up, but he said, yeah, I've got this plit. It turns out that limestone vein I was telling you about, actually, it's got unusual geology along its edge. Carlisle has unusual garnets, copper mines, lime quarries, this, that, and the other, as does Esterbrook Woods. That's all part of that same peculiar geology I was telling you about. So, see how these stories all hang together? So I called up this fellow, Jick Davis, and he said, oh, yeah, I got jade out here. Seemed like a kind of a crufty individual, backwoodsy kind of guy. Yeah, I got jade. Come on out and take a look at it. So I go over to his house, and it turns out that he's living right next to one of the rock pile sites, one of the ones that I know, okay? And I really should just tell you this story, naturally. So he and I are walking through this rock pile site to get to his jade pit.
In Carlisle.
In Carlisle. It's all on Mr. Benfield's property. I tell you that name on purpose. So we go through there, and this guy shows me this, sure enough, something that's, it's a green translucent material. I don't know if it's chemically identical with jade, but it's not a bad, you know, layman's word to describe a green translucent hard material. It comes in these little teeny bits and pieces around the edge of this limestone. So he showed me that. It was very nice, very interesting. Took a little piece of it. And we're heading home back to my car back through the rock pile site. And I'm saying to him, gee, you know, I've been here. I was just here with my son a few weeks ago because my exploration had gotten that far. I've explored out in spirals. We'll talk about that more, I hope, later. But anyway, I'm showing this to this Jick Davis, and there's this place there where it's this big rock, say 8 feet across, 10 feet across, a big rock, sort of like a biscuit shape, triangular biscuit. And it's been cracked horizontally, okay, and been propped up on three wedges, right, just sitting this huge multi-ton rock. Somebody broke it off of its base and propped it up in three places. And I'm pointing this out to this guy, and I'm going, how about these rock piles? He goes, it's field clearing. Yeah, there's people just getting rid of rocks. Yeah, oh, you bet. You know, oh, yeah, I might have been doing some quarrying, and you know, just tossing stuff out of the way. And we get to this table rock, okay? It's called a dolmen in Europe.
Called?
Dolmen, from the Celtic table. Dolmen, D-O-L-M-E-N. Anyway, propped rock, okay? Propped boulder. And I'm going to him, how about that? Is that from field clearing? And he goes, no. That was, and he pauses. He goes, well, sometimes they broke a rock open just to see what the rock was like on the inside. You know, and then they decided that it wasn't any good, and then they moved on. I go, yeah, but then why would they prop it up on those three different things? That's a lot of work, right? And he goes, well, yeah. And then he stopped and paused, and I'm making this part of it up because I don't remember the exact details, but he paused and he goes, you know, you're right. That doesn't make any sense. This is in his backyard. He goes, I've been walking past that for years. You're right, that doesn't make any sense. Huh. About 3 days later, he calls me up. He goes, you know, you're right. I was looking at all this stuff. I, you know, there's this Indian stuff all over the place. And he was off and running. He was really excited about it. Okay. I had showed him a rock pile from Concord that consisted of a rock like a head, another rock like a W, another rock like that, and then a pedestal. And I thought, gee, it looks like a woman, because this looked like breasts and a head and sitting there. But, you know, clouds look like women too, so, and they come and go. It's just not the women, but the clouds. So it's like it doesn't really mean anything. But I had mentioned this to my friend from Carlisle, or maybe I hadn't mentioned it. So, and he wasn't my friend at the time anyway, but he called me back up a few days after our first meeting. He says, yeah, I found this stuff all over. There's a whole bunch of more over here. And, you know, my wife found one. She said, it looks just like a woman sitting there. I go, oh, really? And I got to come take a look at that. So I drive over to Carlisle as soon as I could, maybe the same day. And there's another rock pile that's not identical, but, you know, in terms of yours, I'm going to sketch it. It's identical to the one in Concord. There's one little rock pile on Hanscom Base behind the buildings on that thing they used to call Pine Hill, which they haven't finished raping it completely, but there's a little pocket of woods raping it completely, although they're making a good stab at it right now. I should mention that the people who were building over there promised not to cut down the trees, but they just finished cutting down all the trees. So now Pine Hill is gone. Thank you very much. But anyway, there's one rock pile over there, out of place, one little effigy. And an identical one in Carlisle. Actually, this set me out on a course of trying to find out all the female effigies in the woods. And there's a couple places where there's lots of them, over by Grassy Pond in Acton, on the southern side of Grassy Pond. Little place. There's quite a few really wonderful effigies. But I'm telling you the story of Jick Davis and how I first got to know him, because I don't know how much of this story I can tell, because we have committed crimes. Okay, we've done things that were wrong. We've done things that were right, too. We did what we had to do. Benfield's land, I'm going to say some nasty things here. Mr. Benfield's an old man. He was a wealthy individual who owned many acres in Carlisle. When he began to be non-compos mentis, no longer entirely with it mentally, his lawyers decided that it would be easier to manipulate his estate without his contribution. And they sort of kind of walled him up behind a housekeeper so that Mr. Benfield's only contact with the world was through his lawyers.
This was the fellow who had the jade.
No. The fellow who I had as jade was the forester working for Mr. Benfield, who was not part of the lawyer picture, and who could see what the lawyers were doing and had trouble even getting to talk to Mr. Benfield and did not like what the Carlisle Conservation Fund was likely to do with the Benfield land. Having observed things like the president of the Carlisle Conservation Fund a couple years after a big land donation's made, how come that guy now has a house right on in the middle of that donated land? How did that work out? Okay, you got to see that land preservation around here has its, what's the right word? Some people do it for the love of the land. Some people do it because of the advantages that it brings them. So land conservation, for example, okay, do you know where the conservation lands are in Concord? They're well hidden because many of them were donated by people who wanted the tax relief, but they didn't want people walking in their backyard. So the entrances are hidden, right? I don't know. I kind of don't like the whole concept of people preventing access to the public to things, having a special advantage, which they then leverage into keeping other people away from things. You know, I mean, everybody should get to be an elite, right? Elitism should be accessible to all, essentially. I'm not saying that there shouldn't be elitism, but it shouldn't be like a club, right? And I think my friend from Carlisle thought, and I think that there's legitimate reason for him having thought this, that the lawyers were busily trying to divide up the Benfield estate, sell it off to the highest bidders, and take what advantage they could from the situation. This being my friend's backyard, he didn't want a whole housing development going in there, and he was trying to figure out some way to interfere. Now, I should not be telling you this. He was trying to figure out some way to interfere with the lawyers. Okay? So when I told him there's Indian archaeology on this land, he figured out I can use that. I could. So he made a big fuss, and he started calling up the Indians. Now, this is very important. I think this is very important. My friend from Carlisle, Chick Davis, started calling the Native Americans. He called the Narragansetts. He called them once a month for 2 years, and they always said, no, we can't talk to you. We're busy. Sorry. Out of the office. Not here. Try again some other time. After 2 years, he finally got someone to pick up the phone. And he'd been calling him for 2 years. He said, you've got to come look at this stuff I have in Carla. I think it's Native American stuff. You got to come out here and check it out. Chick's very sociable. He got the Indians out of their shell. They came up, medicine men, tribal elders, ethnographers, a whole troop. I'm resentful of the fact that I missed that original visit because I did spawn it. It was my downstream. And I should have been there, but I wasn't. They walked around, and the Indians go, wow, you're right. This is our stuff. We knew it was here, but we'd forgotten that it was exactly here. Now, there's a whole side story about whether they're telling the truth or not. The fact is, they're not. The Indians have really forgotten almost everything about their prehistory here. They've forgotten where they were, and they've definitely forgotten what they're doing. The Nipmuc, that's the Narragansett, the Nipmuc have not forgotten what they were doing, and they are still building rock piles today. I think not too many of them, and they're not doing a very good job. They don't really know what they're doing. I know more about it than they do, and I can see that they're sort of along the right track, but not really. Whereas when a New Age person builds a rock pile next to the road, I recognize that too. I'm bragging here, but after 5 years of every weekend looking at this stuff, I can read it in a way that, you know, you couldn't if you hadn't been doing it for the same length of time. I'm an expert at it. I can look at it. Anyway, the Indians came up to Carl. They saw and they acknowledged. Now, we believe that the Native Americans made this stuff, and they believe that the Native Americans built this stuff. They are saying that they never lost track of this information. I deny that, because I actually was involved in educating them about this stuff, and I know when I'm telling somebody something that they've already heard, I think. Now, maybe I'm wrong. I think they dimly remember certain things. Ceremonies and rituals aren't something that everybody in a tribe would do. It would be restricted to a very small number of people in a tribe. Would not have been common public knowledge. The only thing that the Narragansetts really did remember was is that they'd had a kind of a circular path that they'd followed, that there was a medicine man cycle of circle of some sort. They weren't sure where it went, right? But when Chick Davis introduced the Indians to this stuff, they for the first time admitted, yes, this is our stuff. Now, this is the NERA group, the people who are fascinated by weird stuff in the woods. They've been trying to get the Indians to admit that it was them for years. I mean, there's a lot of theories about who built this stuff. Celtic journey, you know, St. Brendan, Irish Vikings, this, that, and the other. Now, I think everybody who could have gotten to America did get to America, but I think that if you're in America long, you become a Native American. It's what you have to do to survive, whether you become it by figuring it out yourself or getting absorbed into an existing tribe, I don't know. But from my point of view, it's like, I don't care. It's interesting if your genetics are Viking. It's interesting if your genetics are something other than that. But these are the people who've been on the ground for years. And I know I'm not finishing my sentence properly here. Can't remember what I was saying. Something about Nera. I've lost the thread.
Well, you were talking about the lawyers.
I'm telling you the Benfield story, right? I'm telling you the Benfield story. That's important, right? So, there's a couple different stories to be told here, but the most important one is that Nera and other people have been trying to get the Indians to say maybe they built some of it. We've been trying to figure out who built this weird stuff. Could it have been you, oh, Indians? Now you ask this Indian, you ask that Indian, you ask this other Indian. They all go, no, never heard of that, never heard of that. One guy goes, well, yeah, my family did used to go to this big rock and do this thing once a year. So you hear a little teeny, you get a little hit, a little bit of a hit. But then finally, the Narragansetts came out, and after visiting Carlisle, Doug Harris, who was by birth a Cherokee, but is married into the medicine man family of the Narragansetts, the royalty of the Narragansetts, became their front man for discussing with the Carlisle people what was going on. And Doug Harris, I took Doug Harris on many walks, maybe five walks, maybe three walks in the woods, and I showed this stuff to him. I said, see, this is what it looks like. See, this is where it's found. It's found where water comes out of the ground is where rock piles are, where water comes out of the ground, or places that face west, one thing like that. And I showed him, and I showed him, and I showed him. And then he started revealing that they knew this stuff. How much he knew beforehand, let's say it doesn't matter. I really do believe that the Indians built this. I don't believe that today's Indians remember much about it. They really don't. But I do believe that rock piles have been being built up until about the 60s with knowledge, and I can tell you why I believe that. And then I think that there are still rock piles being built today, and I am sure of that, and I can tell you why. I found a rock pile where dirt had fallen off of the rock from the pile onto the snow that was fresh. So, and I saw the guy's tracks. So I know he was out there doing that. I know where there's a guy still building. There's a guy in Acton still building stuff. He doesn't know what he's doing. There's a guy in Boylston near Rangeway Road. I think that's the name of the road. Randall Road, Rangeway Road, something like that, who's still building rock piles. Sort of knows what he's doing. But I'm telling you the Benfield story. My friend, I also want to tell you the story about the Indians revealing their knowledge of the rock piles. And I want to tell you the story of the Native American reaching out to the towns. It's going on right now. It's an aspect of Native American Anglo history which is born out of this moment, and it's very important, and I can feel quite proud to have been part of this new thing that's being born. I want to tell you more about that, but I'm busy telling you the Benfield story. So, but it's mainly important because it was the spark that lit this still not raging but slow burning fire that's going on. But anyway, so let me put it this way. When I said we did things that were wrong, I won't tell you really the details, but we arranged for it to look like Mr. Benfield invited the Indians to come. Actually, Mr. Benfield might have been more or less awake when he signed the thing that said, please, Indians, come. He didn't actually write the thing that said, please, Indians, come. I had something to do with that. But anyway, a letter was signed by Mr. Benfield inviting the Indians to come. So the lawyers couldn't say, no, the Indians aren't allowed to walk here. They had a signature. So they came and they walked and they saw and they said, this is ours. You cannot just bulldoze this. And this began a little bit of a ripple in the planning of the Carlisle Conservation Fund or Foundation. It's like, oh, gosh, we can't just divvy it up and sell it off to the highest bidder like we were planning. We actually have to, you know, negotiate with people. In the end, it's not clear what happened. We did more surveying. There were several different parcels, but the Carlisle Conservation Fund was, in a sense, blocked from simply behind-the-scenes manipulating of that bit of real estate. That bit of real estate became very public. There were multiple articles written in the Carlisle Mosquito about, Native American rock piles found in this thing, and then one thing and another. So the Benfield land story, which I haven't told very coherently, and I didn't want to tell it too coherently because the role I played in making it look like the Indians were invited legally They weren't really. But it got the Indians out. And so then you had Doug Harris sitting with a small group of landowners at the Seward House. Fred Seward, as in Seward's Folly. Same family. Harvard astronomer. It's funny. Harvard astronomers retire and then get interested in this stuff in the woods because there's a lot of astronomy to be done. There's archaeoastronomy. And these are most of the people who walk around the woods looking at stuff are not scientific. They're spiritual in their interests or who knows what. But there's a few scientists, I'd like to hope that I'm one of them, in there actually trying to research the stuff amidst the people who are trying to have spiritual experiences. Ooh, Indians, birth mother, goddess, fertility, blah, 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 the sky, the sun, the moon. It's like, come on, there's some rocks here. Let's just see what we could see. And I speculate plenty, but not in a spiritual way, in more of a concrete way. I want to know who built these. And I could say that the goal of archaeology in general is to try to put a better face on the past. You want to know who did this? When did they do this? Where did they do this? Who was related to who? What were their individual stories? These are the things we want to find out from archaeology. We don't care that they switched their diet from, you know, walnuts to hickory nuts. That's interesting what they ate. Curtis Hoffman, who I mentioned earlier, makes fun of archaeologists who consider the goal of archaeology to be to figure out what did they eat. And that's the least interesting thing about them. How would you like it if your life was characterized by the food that you'd consumed? Right? Oh, I had Cheerios one day and then I had cornflakes the next day. It's like,
you know, they ate something.
Right. It's just part of the story, but it's not the big part of the story. So, Doug Harris came out. I showed him this stuff. Today, he tells us, Doug Harris is an Indian. Today, he tells the story that he always knew about this stuff and that we let the cat out of the bag and that the Indians now have to admit that this stuff was theirs. I don't think it really happened that way. I think that we showed them that the cat was out of the bag. We were telling them, your Indian stuff is all over the place, but it's very much to the Indians' benefit to have this be known to themselves, to the Anglos, and not benefit from the point of view if we get to grab the land and build a casino, benefit from the point of view if we get to recover some of what's been lost from our culture. Some of the places which we maybe dimly heard about when we were kids, now they're becoming real to us again. A very important set of events happened at Turner's Falls, which is even further west. Turner's Falls was the site of a massacre. Do we have time?
Yep.
Yeah, Turner's Falls was the site of a massacre back in the King Philip's War. It was a place, I can't remember if the Indians massacred the whites or vice versa. I think both happened, and in both cases it was a pretty shitty set of events. And it left that town of, what did I say it was called?
Turner's Falls.
Turner's Falls, thanks. Traumatized in a way that they never recovered from. So even in the 1970s or 80s, going, this is just such a terrible history. Can't we do something? Can't we reconcile with the Indians somehow? So they had a reconciliation ceremony, very nice, I guess, where the Indians came up and said, we forgive you.
In 1970s or something?
No, more like...
More recently.
Yeah, probably this in the last 10 years. The Indians came up and said, we forgive you. Let this town be blessed again. Turner's Falls was a fishing, big fishing place because it's where it's like one of these places where the salmon jump out of the river and everybody fishes for them there. It's a get-together for everybody. So it was a big place for the Indians, and then the whites built mills there and whatever. So most recently, the Indians went out and had a reconciliation at Turner's Falls. Then, and I want to get these things sequentially correct because it's easy to get them confused, and the Indians are already mixing this up, I think, to some extent deliberately. They don't really want it to be clear that I showed them this stuff. They want it to be that they already always knew this stuff. And I'm not the only person. I'm just me. There's other people showing them this stuff, too. But I'm very much part of this story with Doug Harris, the Narragansetts, the Turner's Falls thing. They had gone out to Turner's Falls for a reconciliation ceremony. And it was around that time that I was showing Doug Harris this stuff in the woods.
Benfield
brought Doug Harris up. But beyond Benfield, I was forming a relationship with Doug Harris, showing him things in the woods.
Including Concord?
I don't know if we went... Yeah, we did go one place in Concord. Yeah, we went to Anursnack Hill in Concord.
Spell.
I already spelled it for you.
Oh, all right. We got
come
it.
Come on. Stay. Yeah.
Okay.
It means a strawberry snack, remember?
Oh, yes.
Right. Boy, I can't remember now.
Okay, so Doug
Harris. Wait, Turner's Falls. Turner's Falls. It was around the time of the Turner's Falls things that Doug Harris was also getting tours of the woods from me, being introduced to the stuff by Chick up in Carlisle, and starting to realize that this stuff is real. White guys are starting to be aware of it. Indian guys are starting to be aware of it. It's real. Doug Harris is a politician and an orator. He's a wonderful person. He's sort of like Barack, in a sense. He could charm a bird out of a tree, verbally. And he started making this stuff part of his sort of his standard shtick, his spiel. And then what happened was is that the airport at Turner's Falls wanted to expand. And that's a federal project and requires Native American participation. But I'm forgetting something. After I showed Doug Harris these sites, he said to me, where would you say this stuff is? And I gave him a list of towns. I gave him a list of 8 towns. Concord, Carlisle, Acton, Harvard, Stowe, Boxborough, Bolton. Oh, let's put one more in there. I don't know. Westford, maybe. Who knows? I can't remember what the list was. They then did a thing called the USET resolution. Doug Harris went to the Congress of Eastern Native American Tribes, United South and Eastern Tribes. We white guys don't realize this, but the Indians have their own Congress. It's called USET. So it's a place where the tribes get together and agree on shared policies.
It's called USET?
United South and Eastern Tribes. Current president, I think, is Cheryl Maltese, who's the medicine woman, I think is the correct word, maybe not, for the Aquinnah or the Gayhead Wampanoags on Martha's Vineyard. Doug Harris went from the woods here to a USET meeting in, I don't know, Washington, D.C. or something, and he stood up in front of all of the South and Eastern tribes and said, there are sacred places in the towns of New England. We have to act now to get these things protected. We need to work with the towns, not the state, not the federal government. I'm setting out a policy. I want you guys to approve of this policy. Indians will work with towns, and I will name them. He named 8 towns, the names that I gave him to name. And they made a resolution. They said, anybody who asks us for help in trying to protect these things, we must respond. We recognize and acknowledge the existence of our sacred sites that we've left behind, and if anybody from one of the towns wants our help in trying to protect them, we stand ready. That was their resolution. And in part because of that, they went back to Turner's Falls at the airport expansion, and they decided to look around, and they found rock piles right next to Turner's Falls Airport, and they said, no, you cannot bulldoze this hill. And so they stopped the airport expansion, and it got it listed as a National Register Historic Place kind of thing. Now, this is very interesting. Last year, at a NERA meeting, by phone, they had the speaking over the phone, they had the then president of USET speaking. His name, I can't remember, he was from a tribe in Alabama or Georgia. And he said, we didn't know about this stuff until you told us. I'm talking to Doug Harris. We didn't know about this stuff until you told us. And now we've been applying the same principles that you did at Turner's Falls. And we are now protecting some of the sites down in Alabama. If, by the way, I think that was Oxford, Alabama, and I don't think that fight went too well. If you guys could look it up if you want. The Oxford Mound, it's like Walmart bulldozing. Walmart and sheriff bulldozing ancient Indian mound kind of story. But anyway, the important thing from my point of view is that the guy who was the president of the South and Eastern tribes speaking the words, we didn't know about that stuff until you told us. He was speaking to Doug. But I know where Doug found out about it. Okay? So, one way or another, and I'm maybe more vociferous and a little bit more solid in some ways than a lot of the other NERA people, and I've found a lot more stuff than they have, but I'm not, I didn't create this subject. I didn't create the awareness of these things in the woods. I came along, I heard about it, and I have been elaborating it myself. So, but my role in bringing the Indians out and creating this, so there have been at least one, maybe two more USET resolutions. The USET, the tribes have now resolved that they aren't going to work with, by the way, federal government works with the Bureau of Indian Affairs and the Corps of Engineers, the Army Corps of Engineers. The Army Corps of Engineers and the Native American tribes have a close relationship because the Army Corps of Engineers has to do a lot of projects that are federal projects. All federal projects require Indian okaying, that the land is okay to screw with. I don't know how that came about, but that's the current law. And now there's this whole new dimension to things that you can't screw with. Right? You can't screw with these burials in the woods. You can't screw with the prayer seeds. You can't screw with the effigies. You can't screw with the astronomical alignments and the churches of various forms that they've built out there. You're not supposed to screw with them. That has now come to be formally within the federal development process. And so they had another resolution that said, we urge all federal groups that we're going to be working with to familiarize themselves with this information. So that was the second USET resolution. And, you know, I think that's, I feel proud of that. I mean, something happened there.
It's amazing. What about the present landscape, all the development that's going on in the Concord area now? What effect does this have on these kinds of resources?
In Concord, I think before I forget, let me list where the sites are in Concord. There's one on Nursnock Hill, which is conservation land. There's one on Punkatasset Hill, which is conservation land. I think it's owned by Harvard. I'm not sure. There's one at Willow Guzzle Conservation Land. There's a number of rock piles along the ridge.
Willow
Guzzle Conservation. Guzzle, as in guzzling wine, I guess. Willow Guzzle Conservation Land, if you go from whatever that road to 9 acre corners in towards the east, towards the ridge there, through the swamp, up onto the ridge, you'll find traces of rock piles on the western facing slope of that ridge. And all the way on the north end where the ridge degenerates into swamp and wetland, there's a little bit of a burial ground there, which I couldn't find the other day. I went to look for it, but I remember that there's something there. So there's a little bit of something. Willow Guzzle, Punkatasset, Anursnock, and Yellow Birch Swamp. I told you about what I consider the graveyard there. There's one rock pile isolated by itself on Pine Hill but in Hanscom Field. I know of... Yeah, there's some rock piles behind a guy's yard in... let's head up. Let's go up north on Lowell Road, shall we? Because Esterbrook Woods will be on our right. And I just mentioned that right at Hildreth Corner, there's no rock piles, it's just houses, fancy houses, and then you keep going for a few yards, and there's that, I have to look up the road on the map, I can't remember what it's called. It's a private road, heads into Esterbrook Woods. What's it called? Can I even figure that out? Where is it? No, it's not marked. It's a road, it's like the fourth. It goes over towards Farmer's Cliff. It's a private road, cuts deep into Esterbrook Woods. It comes up sort of almost to the south of Middlesex School. And the next house on Lowell Road has a bit of a swamp next to his driveway, and there's actually some rock piles right there. It's funny. It took me years before I noticed them driving by, but they're visible from Lowell Road in the winter. And then if you were to happen to take this private road, which I can't remember what it's called, you can find a place that there are trails that go in towards Esterbrook Woods. And if you want, you can get out and go visit the Boaz Brown Cellar Hole, which is right there. And you'll see...
B-O-A-Z.
And you can ask yourself the following question. How come there are rock piles all over the Boaz Brown Cellar Hole? Or, if you ask an even better question, go all the way to the north end of Esterbrook Road through the woods, and you'll get to Kibbe Place in Carlisle. And if you happen to have a helpful person who knows the woods there to tell you, he'll show you how to get to the Kibbe Cellar Hole.
K-I-B-B-E-Y?
K-I-B-B-E. Although I think I've seen it spelled other ways. The Kibbe Cellar Hole, which is at the north end of Esterbrook Woods on the Esterbrook Road, is also surrounded by rock piles. Now you ask yourself, well, what's the story there? Here's this guy who's in colonial history. I'll tell you what I remember reading about Kibbe. And yet his cellar hole, his foundation, his house is now gone. And what's left is a whole bunch of rock piles. Not where his foundation is, but next to it there's a big rock pile. Over there is a big rock pile. And what's going on? If he was clearing fields, why was he doing it into his yard? It gets worse. There's a prayer seat built from rocks that were obviously borrowed from the stone wall, just above and looking out over Kibbe's place. So somebody came after the stone wall was built, pulled it apart, and built a prayer seat to look out over Kibbe's place. What's going on with that? You can go take a look at these things. It's a little stone U made with boulders about this big. A little U about big enough for a person to sit in, facing, I guess, south or southwest or something. So you're going, what's up with that? So here was a guy, Kibbe. Kibbe is supposed to have been a very big man, and his daughters were huge. They were all big people. They were so big, this is all that is told in the thing that I read, they were so big that he couldn't get them all to church because he only had like one horse or two horses. He didn't have enough horse to get all of his daughters to church. So he'd take one of them a week, and they'd have to rotate. So once they got to go once every 3 weeks or something. So this is all I've heard about Kibbe. Big guy. And when his house was part of what was about to become incorporated as the town of Carlisle, he said, I didn't do this, that, and the other for this. I want to stay as part of Concord. They said, okay, you could be part of Concord. So the town border made a little digression, It went around his properties in such a way as to leave him connected to Concord. I don't think after a few years anybody cared much anymore. But that's what we know about Kibbe from the, without further archival research, which I'm not the kind of right person to do. Big guy, oddball guy, right? Now, here's my question. Was Kibbe a Native American pretending to be a white? Because the way the Native Americans survived was to stop being Native American. Not really, but to all appearances. They became French, they became Irish, they became eccentric people living at the edges of town. I don't know, but after Kibbe left, there were rock piles built after he left. And I know this because, the stone wall, presumably, if you want, is from Kibbe's period. And yet you can go up above his property and you can see where they pulled the rocks off the stone wall, because the stone wall's there and it's missing the rocks. And then you can see and you can count them. Here are the rocks, and they're in a little U-shaped structure. Did somebody really go to that bottom so they could go out and drink some beer? I don't think so. Somebody built a U there for some reason. If you look at the rock piles at Kibbe's place, there's some of them are pretty peculiar. It's not just dumped rock. There's one place where there's a boulder with like a wall built up on top of it. And you don't know, could that have been a crib for something, a corn or what? I don't know. When I find rock piles at a house site like this, they're the most mystifying of all. Really don't know what's going on. I visited one, I think it was yesterday. I get it mixed up, yesterday or the day before. There's a number of places where there's cellar holes surrounded by rock piles, and I don't really know what's going on there. Let me just almost be done now, okay? But I've told you the Benfield story. I've showed you the maps. The main clusters of rock piles are following this upthrust of land. At the upper right is in Carlisle, and it goes down into Acton and cuts across into Stowe. It goes into Bolton, touches on Harvard, goes out past Boylston.
It's essentially a ridge, or...?
It's a ridge of really cruddy land that water is just seeping out of. And for some reason, it's where all the rock piles are. I think the Native Americans that were left here when the Anglos came weren't rich, didn't have good land. So the places where their stuff would have been least disturbed and most refreshed would have been the edges of towns, the the useless land at the edges of things, the forgotten land, the fringe land, the remaindered land. So I've been looking at rock piles. Now I've come back to a little bit more personal. I've been looking at rock piles for 4 or 5 years. I found more of them than anybody else in the world. I blog about them. So you know what a blog is. So I have a daily log, which doesn't get a daily entry every day. But I've got about 3 days' worth of stuff already because I saw sites yesterday and I saw sites the day before that, new sites.
And you keep entering all this information on the blog.
I try to keep up with it. There's an ongoing question about how much I reveal because you don't want people going to tear these things up out of the misguided belief that there's something inside them. There usually isn't anything inside of them as far as I know. I've never dug one up. So what more do I want to tell you? I found hundreds of these things, and over time, at first you start trying to classify them as big, small, made out of this, made out of that, coming in groups of three, that sort of thing. And then eventually the things that you really should be paying attention eventually begins to penetrate your consciousness. And I mean, the key question I have is how many different groups of people were building rock piles in the past, and were the reasons and motivations different? And, you know, it's like I say, what you want to know about the past is who did what, where, and when, and who else did it, and how were they related, and what are their stories? This is what you want to figure out. You start off here in Concord, and most of the rock pile sites are low, and they're near the wetlands. Okay, and then you go out a little bit more towards Boxborough and Harvard, and you start finding rock pile sites on the tops of hills more than you do around here. And then you get out into the Fitchburg area, or also a little bit further south, and you find many rock pile sites really on prominent places to look out. Okay, and you start trying to understand what's where. I've had a lot of fun exploring Leominster State Forest and a place called Mount Elam. In Leominster, you go to the southern end of Mount Elam Road, south of Route 2, and you just follow the dirt road into the woods, and it won't be long before you come into an area that is filled with probably 50 huge stone mounds. I mean, these things are impressive. They should absolutely be on every tourist's map. It's like, Leominster, they don't know what they've got. They've got the city of the, they've got the what do you call it? The capital of the Inland Empire. Out in Leominster, but let me talk a little bit more coherently. You start out around here, and you see little rock piles in the swamps, mainly is what it's about, is swampy kind of stuff. And you see examples of rock piles that look like they're shaped in some way. Like I found a rock pile shaped like a fish. It just looked like a fish. I mean, you look at it, you go, yeah, that looks like a fish. It's, you know, it's got a tail, and you know, it's got fins and a tail. It's next to a river. And then you see a spiral on the ground, and you go, is that a snail, or is that a medicine man, what, endogenous, you know, psychoactive experience, or something more mundane, like it's a picture of the food supply, snail. It's a picture of a fish, food supply. We're right here, we're next to where they come, snails and fish come from, right there. I don't know. That's what you see here in this part of the town, and as I say, it's a little bit different out in Boxborough. Slightly different in Harvard, and then you cross the big divide of the Nashua River, and you get out into the hills west and south of Leominster and Fitchburg, and then it's very much a different picture. Qualitatively, you say the mounds are bigger, something else is going on out there. So I'm going to tell you a very particular story, which is my current preoccupation. I've been noticing for some time that a lot of the larger rock piles have a hollow in them, a place, a little caved-in place. And you have different explanations for what that hollow might be, and maybe it would be a mistake to say that all hollows are the same. This is very obscure stuff, so bear with me. I'm the only person in the world who cares about this, but maybe somewhere, in the future, someone will care about this.
The rocks or the rock piles?
The rock pile is here, and it'll be like a little concavity in the middle of the pile. Some people think it's for a seat, a place to sit. Other people think that's where a vandal tried to dig a hole. But lately, I've come to the belief that a lot of times it's an interior chamber that has fallen in. Okay? It's perfectly possible that none of these are true or that all of these are true. But I'm just going to go with, for the moment, my sense that some of them... I'm walking with my friend from Carlisle, Chick Davis, but we're up by Woodbridge Road in Carlisle. And we're walking along the edge of a swamp in a place where I never would have expected to find any rock piles, because usually rock piles, there's some kind of view or some kind of water source or something, and this is not the edge of a swamp or an edge of a marsh. And we start coming to rock piles, and they're just like messy, look like they're just somebody discarded rocks. Easy to believe that these are just pushed to the edge of the viable land. But then we come across one, and it's a rectangle. It's a nice rectangle, maybe 10 feet by 8 feet. Or no, make that 12 feet by 10 feet. A nice, solid rectangle. How high is that? 3.5 feet high. And in the middle of it is a rectangular hole. And it's rectangular. You can see that it's rectangular. And I'm not making this up. We could go look at it. I have the pictures. I'm not lying. And so you go, and somebody went to some bother, because this is a constructed hole, all right, with rectangular sides in the middle of the pile. And then at the end of the pile, this is very funny, there's this little bit of a stone wall for about 8 feet, a little tail stuck out of the thing. So you've got this very strange structure, a rectangular structure of around the dimensions I described, a little bit of a stone wall coming out of it, and a rectangular hole in it. Go, that's definitely a deliberate hollow. That's a hollow, you say to yourself. And that's not something that somebody vandalized and dug in there. And that's not a seat to be sitting somewhere. That's an interior chamber in this thing. It's square. I don't know why. Now let's go back and look at those three piles we just passed that we didn't really make much sense out of. You go back and look at them. By God, that one's got a hollow in exactly the same location. And look, it's got a tail too. So then we're walking along, and there's a third one. Rectangular pile. Hollow, not such a nice rectangular hollow, but just more like a depravity. A depression with a little bit of a tail sticking out of the thing. And I say, now that is very, very characteristic structure. I don't know what the heck that's for, but I know when I see the same three things in a row that there's something there. And anybody wants to talk about this being field clearing, it's like, go away. You know, we've got the grown-ups are here to talk about the real subject matter. If you want to talk about the facts, fine. If you want to talk about field clearing, go away. You know, I just have no interest in talking to people who are that much oblivious to the reality. So here we are, and I'm going, you know, that's so structured and so characteristic. I bet you I can find some more now that I know what to look for. So I said, now, this is unusual because unlike some other places, I've been looking at hollows all spring. I've been looking at hollows mostly on prominences that look out over the valley or look out towards Mount Wachusett. I had been looking at them in places like Boylston and Hopkinton, a little bit south of here. But they're up high, and this is down low near the water in Carlisle, and I found these things with tails. So I took out the map, and I said, I think this is part of that same tradition that I associate with Mount Wachusett. I think that this is stuff that's further from more to the west than to the east. So I'm going to go, I think I found some stuff like that by a place called Muddy Pond in Westminster. So, you know, why don't I go, split the difference, let's go north of Fitchburg. I'll take out the map, I don't have my Fitchburg map, I take out the map north of Fitchburg. I'll look for some bodies of water, okay? Where I can walk around. Okay, here's a nice looking little body of water. Wright's Pond. Or Wright Ponds. I don't know where you put the S there.
Spelled.
That's what I'm telling you. I don't know if it's Wright Pond or Wright's Ponds or Wright's Pond or Wright Ponds.
First letter.
W-R-I.
Oh, yeah. Right. W-R-I-G-H-T apostrophe S P-O-N-D-S. Plural. But interestingly, it has a Native American name that also seems to refer to a pair of ponds. It's not clear that it's two ponds with a little brook between them, and I don't know what happens downstream, but it doesn't look too man-made. It's just like a natural pair of ponds with a short stretch of brook. So I got out there, and I was planning to walk around the pond one way, but I couldn't because there was gunfire coming from that direction, and you know, it's scary walking in the woods when there's bullets flying around. I could tell you about that too. That'd be interesting. you know, what it's like to walk in the woods and get scared by something. A moose, a hunter, an irate landowner. Anyway, between right ponds, so I couldn't go the way I wanted to, so I just walked down the road to the where the road crossed the brook that joined the two ponds. And just look, oh, look, there's some rocks over there in the weeds. And I go down and I look, and remember what I'm looking for is rock piles with a hollow and a tail. And that's what was there. So I go down there and I go, gee, that's just a mess. Oh, there's the tail. Oh, there's the hollow. Got it. Perfect. Is there anything else around here? Oh, yeah, I can see a couple rock piles over there in the bushes, but what's that over there? And then I found a different one, which is a different style, which is basically a rectangular pile like this. You have to look for a second. Like that with a hollow right there. Just like places where there's grass growing up in one spot, but otherwise it's a rock pile. It's a rectangular rock pile about this high or this high. This, not high, a foot or so high, low to the ground. And there's grass growing up in one space in it. And I tell you, I've seen that now over and over and over. So like the next weekend, I go out with my wife and say, let's go drive next to some brooks. Let's find some brooks up near north of Fitchburg. Cross a brook on West Ashby Road. Cross the Falula Brook. Don't ask me where the name comes from. I'm looking out the window, go, oh, isn't there something in the bushes over there? Ah, pull over, get out. There's this rectangle with the grass growing up in this one little quadrant of it. Other side of the road, something much more confusing and tumbling. I said, maybe we should look around a little bit more, go deeper down along the brook a little bit. There's some huge mounds in there. I go, are they hollows? Have those got hollows? I mean, so what is this about? I have to come up with some answer. That's inherent to being an amateur. As you look, you observe, you try to speculate about what you're seeing. Unrestrained by the academic stuff that saying things can be equivalent to losing a job, I have the wonderful luxury of saying whatever I feel like about this and not worrying about losing my job.
And what is it that's to be said about these things?
That these are probably burial mounds. That's what they are everywhere in the world. You put up a pyramid-shaped thing, large or small, and you do it because you put a body in it. And it's part of an elaborate physics, if you want, because religion isn't different from physics in a non-industrialized society. It's the physics of how the soul gets to heaven. You know, the pyramids are all supposed to be an elaborate mechanism for getting the soul up into the stars, right? And I think that, you know, in the Mayans and their pyramids, what do you find in the middle of the pyramid? You find a body. So, if it was like here as it is elsewhere, mounds here would be to be burial mounds. That's what they're for. I think the hollow was where the body went. And now, I don't know about this, Native Americans apparently would move the remains of their ancestors when they would move. They'd take their bones with them. Do you know this? Mm-hmm. At least in some tribes. The reason this is known is because they've dug up skeletons that had soil from a different place in them. Right? So apparently the Native Americans, this isn't too different from the Chinese, they would inter remains, but then they would disinter them, I guess that's the phrase, and then they would take them, reinter them in some other location, as long as it's got to be interred, interred, reinterred, disinterred, reinterred. Okay, so it all comes back in a cycle. I don't know. I mean, you're looking at these rather elaborately constructed structures, and by the way, there's many, many different kinds of rock piles in the woods. I'm only talking about one narrow group of them. The reason it's important to me, this one narrow group, is because it's the first, this is speaking about rock piles with hollows in them, that provides me to say, I know this one thing. Right? I know this rock pile with a hollow. I recognize that as a rock pile with a hollow. It's rectangular. It has a tail. If it's down by the water, up in the heights, they lose the tail for reasons such I don't know, but they're still rectangular. They still have the hollow. This is one thing I know. And if I know this, I can start looking at other things from the point of view of what I do know, okay? So first part of the story is I recognizing the hollows and then seeing some of them associated with rock piles with tails on them, and I start tracking them, tracking the long-tailed rock pile through the wilds of Middlesex County. That's the name of my adventure book. It's got a picture of a guy with muscles and girls climbing up and standing there on top of a pile. You've seen that picture, right? Like the National Lampoon. It's So where am I?
So it was one particular type of rock pile. Rock piles with hollows and with tails permits me to sit there and go, well, first of all, I track that. And I can tell you, there's very few of those in this part of the world. There's one down in Lincoln that I know about. And that's it. The next one that I know in this far east, that we're talking about rock piles with hollows, is in Framingham. And there's not a whole lot of them, all right? But I can go up to any hill around Wachusett. If it faces Wachusett, if it hasn't been built on, and let's come back to your question about how is building impacting this, and I can look for these things and I find them. I know where to look. I know where they are. And I understand what they are. At least I believe so. It's a coherent theory. Whether it's correct or not, maybe it doesn't matter. It's a coherent theory that there was a culture associated, which I call the Wachusett tradition, that built burial mounds that included enclosing probably just the bones, maybe not the rest of the body, in a little hollow and building it into a rock pile. I think the tail on some of these rock piles represents the edge of an open enclosure that was adjoined to the rock pile, where probably some part of the funerary activity was going on. So, you know, if they were leaving a body out to dry in the sun, or if they were burning it and chopping it into pieces, whatever you would do to get the bones, I don't know. That would maybe go on outdoors in this little enclosure. I don't know. I'm just saying, you got a rock pile and you got this hooked thing next to it over and over again. It's part of the structure. It has a function. I don't know what the function is, but I have to sort of put together a picture. So instead of my picture of the great game hunters looking a lot like Cro-Magnon and Neanderthal, I'd put together a picture of a burial mound at Indians preparing a body in the open place and leaving a cyst, is that the right word, or a crypt, what's the right word, that either a fetal position body or the bones would go in afterwards, and then you'd cover that over. And the reason they're open today is because neither one was covered, neither the tailed part nor the hollowed part was not always capped with stones. So sometimes it would be capped with brush, I guess. And so today it's open, and there's nothing there. Anyway, to make a long story just even a little bit longer, tracking the hollow rock piles with tails through the wilds of Middlesex County, out to Westminster, down through Leominster, and swinging back around into Boylston and down into Hopkinton, I can now say, I know this one thing. I know that this is one of the cultures that was doing one of the things. So why is this valuable to me is because I get to go look at something else now and say, now, is that part of this culture or is that something different? So I use the word Wachusett tradition as a concession or acknowledging of the fact that many of these sites seem to be around Mount Wachusett, facing Mount Wachusett. It's an inland manifestation. It's not a coastal manifestation. At least I don't think it is. So, for example, the weekend before last, I wanted to go look at a big mound that I knew of down in Weston. Do I mean Weston? I think I mean Weston. Near Weston College, off of Ripley Lane. I say these things specifically so people can find them if they want. Because I wanted to know if I knew that there was a big mound down there, and I took pictures of it in the past, but I didn't know whether I should look for hollows or look for tails, okay? So I go down there and I look, and what do you know? It's not rectangular. What do you know? There is no hollow. What do you know? There's no tail. Well, okay, it's not a big deal, but what that means to me is that that's something different. So I'm trying to explain, what does knowing about hollows mean? It means that I know this one thing, but if I know this one thing, then I know when it's something else. So now with one foot on the ground, you see, I'm going to do a little dance for the microphone. I've got one foot on the ground, and I'm in a dark room, but I have one foot planted. It means I can go like this. I can feel around me and see and extend my understanding. I'm doing a little dance with tippy toe with the right foot, and left foot is solidly placed, okay? Do you understand my point? So I go to Weston, and I look, and I go, no. That's not a rock pile with a hollow and a tail. That's something different. Let me see if there's anything else like that around. And where was I yesterday? Or the day before yesterday? Yesterday we were in Boxborough, Patch Hill, conservation land. You take the lower trail in, and you come to a place where there's this very, very massive stone wall next to the trail. and go look on the other side of that massive stone wall, and you'll find a beautiful rectangular stone pile, low to the ground, with a huge chunk of quartz symmetrically placed along one of the sides. And it's not, then you look more carefully, there's no hollows, it's not rectangular, it's actually more like a pentagon, so sort of shaped like that, and then this part is curved. It's sort of two-thirds of a pentagon and then a curved outline. And then behind it is another one, also not quite rectangular, also with one piece of quartz in it. No hollows, a different phenomenon. That's all. I mean, I'm not saying anything too profound other than, okay, you don't want to have everything all be the same subject, nor do you want to have 10,000 little subjects for a proper approach to something. You want to kind of to group into, you know, reasonable subsets that you can focus on and, you know, get to know. And so the rock piles with hollows, knowing about them helps me see that that's not the same thing as what I'm seeing in Boxborough. That's not the same thing as what I'm seeing in thing. But on the other hand, if you go up, if you go out Route 2, just as you cross over the past Route 111 and you go over the height of land in Harvard, if you happen to look to the south of the road, you'll see a beautiful, huge, 20-foot-long rock pile, 25-foot-long rock pile, big and rounded, oblong. You go, wow, that's magnificent. Anything else like that around? I spent quite a long time exploring that part of the woods around Route 2, never found a thing. And then I realized, you know, there's some woods on the other side of Route 2. And I circled outward, and then finally I got to another one about a quarter of a mile away. Same shape, but this one had been torn open and it had two hollows in it. So I go, all right, that's part of the hollow world, but it's at the edge of it. It's just, there's no tail, a little different, two hollows, placed slightly differently. So it's like, that's still where my foot is planted on the ground, but it's a little bit at the edge of the standard design. And so now I can do stuff like this. I can say, well, in Hopkinton you have this with the hollows, with these other piles strewn around, and then you got the same thing in Boylston, same kind of thing, looking out, same kind of stuff strewn around. Then you got something slightly different when you get up into Harvard. And I don't know, it's a long way from having a complete picture, but with hundreds and hundreds of sites to explore. Now, I'm shifting my gears from discovering new sites to going back and trying to put sense into the things that I've seen. And with one central part that I do understand, in the sense of having named it and being able to recognize it and identify it, this rock piles with hollows, this Wachusett tradition, with that understood, I'm starting to be able to expand and say what might be related to it, or what must be different from it. For example, I took my wife on a drive Saturday, and I thought, let's go out west, let's go to the other side of Wachusett. So it's a bit of a drive from here, you know, it's a 45-minute drive just to get out past Wachusett. Picked a road, driving along, and oop, there are some rock piles, but they're sort of covered with trees and debris, and all around is cellar hole. I was saying, I don't know what to do with that, and took some pictures, keep driving, oop, there's a big one, get out. Now we're talking about big mounded rock piles with no hollows and no tails. And they're round. They're not rectangular. And that was interesting, one of them. And then we drove a little further, parked, went into the woods, and there was another one. Big, round, no hollows. So I'm going, okay, I don't know what this is, but I do know that it's not the rectangular with the hollow stuff that I'm seeing further east. So I really hope over time to get better distribution maps, in the sense that, you know, the question was, who did what, when, and where? And who else did it? Well, who is somebody, I call them the Inland Empire. I think that they must have been the ancestors of the Nipmuc. Where they did it, mostly west of here. There's very few of these in this part of town. Okay. When, I think this is Middle Woodland. I need to digress for a second, but there was a mound builder culture in the Mississippi and Ohio River valleys, which was in what we call the Middle Ages, so the 800 through 1400 AD, that sort of time frame. The Vikings were coming and going up in Greenland and Labrador, but things got cold for them. The water temperatures got colder. Their ability to farm in Greenland disappeared. They stopped coming, right? There were big battles between the Native Americans and the European
Americans in 1300 and 1400s. I know this is fringe up the wazoo, but there were, I think, probably European-derived cultures in the Ohio Valley. That was different from the mound builder cultures. Whatever about, who knows about the European cultures? They've just begun to become aware of that. There are iron furnaces all through Ohio that are prehistoric, and yet Native Americans weren't supposed to have been smelting, so they can go figure that out on their own. But in any case, there were big mound builder cultures in the Mississippi Valley. You've heard about the mound builders, right? And you've heard about the Mayans, and they were big mound-building cultures, and they were in Central America. And everywhere in between were mound-building cultures. So the Caddo in Texas were building small mounds. The, I can't remember what they're called, the Natchez further east, they were building small pyramids. And having everywhere in America was a mound-building culture. And New England is economically always one of the most rich resource-rich areas that exist in America. We've got it all. We've got reasonably good agriculture, not a very good, not such a long growing season, but long enough. We've got the ocean. We've got the rivers. We've got it all. This has always been the most popular part of America, and here I'm going to make something up based on the weight of the obvious. During the mound builder culture era in America, 800 to 1400 AD, what's called the woodland period, especially the middle woodland period. This was absolutely as much the center of the world as anywhere else. The question is, where are the mounds, right? And I'm telling you where the mounds were. They're here. They're built out of rock, and they're smaller. If you want to see an earthen mound, something actually a pyramid, go down Route 2, and just before you hit 128 on the way into town, you'll start hitting the reservoir. And the first piece of water that you see on the right, a little finger that stretches west a little bit, runs along Route 2 for a moment before you get to 128. If you look across that water, looking south from Route 2, just as you exit, you just crossed into Lexington a few feet ago, there you will see what looks like an earthen mound right next to the reservoir there. So shaped like this, flat top thing. It's only about 15 feet high. And maybe it's natural, but it looks artificial. In any case, these stone mounds are not natural. Probably the big ones are probably for burials. And there are thousands and thousands of these, and nobody's looking at them, and it's absolutely the cutting edge of archaeology today. Massachusetts archaeologist, the guy who's currently editing the journal, the bulletin, is a rock pile knowledgeable and aware person, and he is opening up the pages of the official academic publications to this type of stuff. Hopefully, when the generation of know-it-alls dies off, the Stephen Williamses of Harvard, the Dina Dinkowski of UMass, the people who think they know and who have what's the right word, to sit in court over, to adjudicate, to
preside.
Those who have presided over the destruction of archaeology in Massachusetts will slowly but eventually get out of the way. And some of the younger people will not have these same prejudices and will study this stuff with interest. As for development destroying rock piles, yeah, you bet. What are you going to do? Curiously enough, a lot of times the rock piles that are there are on the shittiest piece of land around, and it seems to manage to often seem to sort of like the development just went right around it somehow. Don't know why the rock piles survived. Surely there are thousands killed every day, but they survived too. I don't know what to think. I mean, on Route 62 in Hudson, right near Route 495, they shaved off an entire hill and a half. And the half that got left is the place where the rock piles were. So, I don't know. Go figure. Just mentioned some odds and ends. Knobscot Hill is a big hill in Sudbury. You want to know where the rock piles are? They're on the northwestern slope below the orchard, but they're all over that side of the hill. Callahan State Park, you can find some stuff down along the water. Mount Pisgah, stuff in the valley between the two lobes of the hill up that runs north-south through the hill. Rocky Pond, Boylston, this wonderful site on the right-hand side there. I'm just telling you the big places that I can think of.
Todman Hill Road in Harvard runs past a very tall hill that's owned by a family called Brown. The very tippy top of the hill is an incredible rock pile site. It was found by Bruce McAleer. Center of Boxborough, there's a hill. It belongs to private property. It's covered with rock piles and effigies and what have you. Boxborough is full of rock piles everywhere you look. Different types, sometimes bunches of little ones, sometimes these grave-like things, sometimes these mounds. I was very pleased. I cut into the wrong part of the swamp over in Boxborough near the Holiday Inn. Instead of going into Wolf Swamp, which is where the conservation land parking was, I went on the opposite side of the street. Said, I think I'm going to keep going until I hit houses. I hit rock piles first, and I found a low mound. I would have thought it was a mess, but then I said, no, I think that's a hollow.